Today is Wednesday, June the 25th, 2025. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how Big Tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a 3-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. That's www.prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Relocate in 30 days or resign. Amazon's tough message to remote employees. Amazon is enforcing its return to office policy with a strict ultimatum. Employees must relocate to their assigned office within 30 days or resign. This decision follows previous mandates requiring 3 days a week in the office, which many employees resisted. The company faces internal protests and concerns about talent retention as it prioritizes in-person collaboration. In a surprising move that's shaking up the tech world, Amazon has issued a stern warning to its employees. Report to your assigned office location within 30 days or resign. This latest development follows the company's strict return-to-office policy, now being enforced with a comply-or-quit approach. For many workers still operating remotely, the clock is ticking. Amazon cracks down on remote work flexibility. Amazon had already made its stance clear on in-person work. In 2023, it introduced a mandate requiring employees to work from the office at least 3 days a week. However, thousands of staffers continue to operate from different cities, resisting relocation. According to insiders, Amazon is now tightening the screws. Employees who fail to move to their assigned hub offices will reportedly be given a 30-day deadline to imply or face a 60-day window to voluntarily resign. While Amazon has not publicly acknowledged a mass layoff strategy, the firm confirmed that it is communicating directly with non-compliant employees and offering them options if they can't relocate. There is internal resistance as employee backlash have already been triggered by the return-to-office push. Over 30,000 workers signed a petition against the policy last year, and hundreds of them stage a walkout. Many contend that the abrupt change violates earlier pledges of flexibility and makes work-life balance more difficult, particularly for individuals who relocated during the pandemic. Additionally, some Amazon teams, particularly those in engineering, tech and human resources remain dispersed by design. Opponents claim that making them move go against the company's own dedication to innovation and retaining talent. Is Amazon's hybrid work a gamble, bold or risky? Amazon maintains that in-person work strengthens team collaboration and long-term company culture. CEO Andy Jassy has repeatedly emphasized the benefits of face-to-face interactions, but with morale reportedly slipping and attrition rising in some departments, experts are divided on whether this return-to-office clampdown will pay off or push valuable talent out the door. OpenAI wants Microsoft, who has 49% stake in OpenAI, to accept 33% in a restructure for profit business. Recent reports indicate that negotiations between OpenAI and Microsoft regarding Microsoft's equity stake are ongoing and have faced some tension. OpenAI is reportedly seeking to transition its for-profit LLC into a public benefit corporation, a move that requires Microsoft's approval. During these discussions, OpenAI is said to be willing to offer Microsoft a 33% equity stake. However, Microsoft is reportedly pushing for a larger stake, potentially closer to the 49% it had been entitled to in profits under previous agreements. Microsoft is also reportedly prepared to rely on its existing commercial agreement, which grants it access to OpenAI's technology until 2030, if an agreeable deal is in reach. The negotiations are complex, involving not only the equity stake, but also other aspects of their partnership, such as Microsoft's exclusive rights to resell OpenAI's models and access to intellectual property. Microsoft is prepared to walk away from high-stakes negotiations with OpenAI over the future of its multi-billion dollar alliance as the ChatGPT maker seeks to convert into a for-profit company. Microsoft has considered halting complex discussions if the two sides remain unable to agree on critical issues such as the size of Microsoft's future stake in OpenAI, said people with inside knowledge of the plans. In this eventuality, Microsoft would rely on its existing commercial contract to retain access to OpenAI's technology until the year 2030, unless there was an offer that was equal to or better than its current arrangements. Microsoft and OpenAI said in a joint statement, "We have a long-term, productive partnership that has delivered amazing AI tools for everyone. Talks are ongoing, and we are optimistic we will continue to build together for years to come." OpenAI needs a deal with Microsoft to complete a move away from its nonprofit origins into a more conventional corporate structure, which it believes will unlock funding and launch an initial public offering. Microsoft must approve the switch by the end of the year, or OpenAI risks losing billions of funding from other investors, including SoftBank. The pair are also revising the terms of its wider contract, first drafted when Microsoft invested $1 billion into OpenAI back in the year 2019. Under its current arrangement, Microsoft has exclusive rights to sell access to OpenAI's models and receive a 20% share of revenues up to $92 billion. Microsoft is reluctant to give ground on its continued access to OpenAI's technology or its share of the group's revenues, according to multiple people close to the discussions. What leverage does OpenAI have in the negotiations? The Wall Street Journal recently reported that OpenAI had considered a nuclear option of accusing Microsoft of anti-competitive behavior over its partnership. Well, if they're partners, how can one partner sue another partner about anti-competitive behavior? One person close to Microsoft said the status quo was acceptable for the big tech company and that it was happy with the current contract and prepared to run it through until the year 2030. The market cares about how much revenue Microsoft is making, not about how much equity it owns in OpenAI, and this deal moves revenue away from Microsoft. The question is, what does Microsoft get in return for giving up the right to that revenue? Microsoft has begun diversifying away from OpenAI's models in recent months as part of Chief Executive Satya Nadella's belief that leading models will become commoditized or have less value than being able to sell AI-enabled applications and digital assistants built on top of them. Back in May, Microsoft made Elon Musk xAI model Grok, that's G-R-O-K, available on its cloud computing customers. OpenAI is not necessarily the front runner anymore, said one person close to Microsoft, remarking on the competition between rival AI model makers. Several other elements of the current contract are also up for negotiation, including Microsoft's exclusive rights to sell OpenAI software through its Azure cloud computing service, its right of first refusal to provide computing infrastructure to OpenAI, and the software giant's access to the AI group's intellectual property before it reaches artificial general intelligence. The latter clause refers to a point where OpenAI creates a highly autonomous system that outperforms humans at most economically valuable work and is likely to be dropped, as the Financial Times previously reported. OpenAI's chief executive, Sam Altman, and its chief financial officer, Sarah Friar, have also said the company is struggling to access the computing power needed to run ChatGPT, which has over 500 million weekly active users worldwide, while also training new models and launching products. Two former Microsoft executives involving managing OpenAI's compute requirements said the relationship between the groups had frayed significantly over the issue, particularly around Sam Altman's demands for faster access to more infrastructures. Even if the issues are resolved, the transaction will have to be approved by attorneys general in Delaware and California. The conversion is also subject to a legal challenge from Elon Musk, which has been supported by former OpenAI employees. Google tests real-time AI voice chats in Search. Search Live is coming to AI mode, but you'll only be able to interact with it using your voice for now. Google's building Search Live into AI mode, allowing you to have a back-and-forth voice conversation with the company's AI chatbot right from its search engine. The test, which is rolling out now to labs users in the United States, currently doesn't support camera sharing, but Google plans to add the capability in the coming months. Search Live lets you interact with the company's custom version of Gemini and Search the web in real time. The feature currently lives in the Google app on Android and iOS, and where it takes things a step further by giving you the ability to point your camera at something and ask questions about it out loud. Google first announced plans to bring Search Live to AI mode, the AI-powered search feature that just rolled out to everyone in the United States last month. It's all part of Google's larger transformation of its search engine, which is also experimenting with putting podcast-like audio overviews into your search results. You can try out Search Live in AI mode by opting into the AI mode experiment in Google Labs. From there, head to the Google app on Android or iOS and tap the new live icon. You can then ask a question out loud like, "What are some tips for preventing a linen dress from wrinkling in a suitcase?" The AI chatbot will provide an audio response, and you can reply with another related question like, "What should I do if still wrinkles?" Search Live will also present you with relevant links as you chat. Other AI companies have spent time building out voice modes for their AI models as well, with OpenAI launching an advanced voice mode in ChatGPT last year, and Anthropic rolling out a voice mode for its Claude app in May. Apple is also working on an LLM Siri, but its rollout was delayed because the company wasn't able to achieve the reliability that it wanted, according to Apple Software SVP Craig Federighi. Google says Search Live operates in the background, letting you continue a conversation with a chatbot when navigating to other apps. You can also tap the transcript button to see a text version of the response and reply by typing. Google will save past Search Live conversations in your AI mode history. Google Gemini now powers Chrome. Google Gemini is now available in Chrome as a built-in AI assistant. Use it to summarize pages, enhance searches, and write faster. Learn how to enable Gemini in Chrome and make browsing more productive with this simple setup guide. Google has added its Gemini AI assistant directly into Chrome. This update lets you write faster, summarize pages, and search smarter, all from your browser. There is no need for extra plugins or switching between tabs. Start by updating Chrome to the latest version. Then sign in with your Google account. Go to Settings, AI Features, and turn on Enable Gemini Assistant. Restart the browser once. You'll see the Gemini icon appear beside the address bar. Click it anytime to open the AI sidebar. You can ask questions, get suggestions, or rewrite content from there. Use Gemini to summarize pages and generate better content. Right-click on any part of a page, select Summarize with Gemini to get a quick overview. You can also click the sidebar icon to ask Gemini for more detailed breakdowns. While replying to emails or filling forms, you'll spot a Write with Gemini option. It helps you draft responses, polish your grammar, and even rewrite paragraphs with clarity. Start typing in Chrome's address bar. Gemini instantly fetches concise results using live web data. You won't need to scroll endlessly or open multiple tabs. This feature works best when researching or checking quick facts. For deeper questions, use a sidebar for longer, AI-driven responses. Works across emails, documents, and comment fields. Gemini shows up inside text boxes on most websites. Use it in Gmail, Google Docs, or even when commenting on blogs. It speeds up writing, rewrites rough drafts, and fixes tone or grammar, all with a few clicks. Early users say writing tasks feel 30% faster now. Whether you're a student drafting essays or a professional replying to emails, Gemini saves time. Some websites block AI interaction. In those cases, you may need to copy and paste content manually. Gemini also cannot function offline. Complex questions may lead to vague replies, so keep your prompts simple. The tool continues to improve as Google adds updates. Google promises data privacy and future upgrades. Your chats with Gemini stay private. Content gets encrypted and only activates when you give permission. You can also clear your AI history anytime through your Google account settings. Google plans to roll out voice commands, deeper workspace integration, and live transcription support soon. By the end of the year, expect Chrome's version of Gemini to match the full desktop tool. Add Gemini from the Chrome Web Store. Head to the Chrome Web Store and search for Gemini AI. Install it like any other extension. You'll unlock smart assistants across your browser with just a few tweaks. No need to jump between tools with Gemini and Chrome. Everything stays in one window and productivity remains high. Apple's WWDC, which is the Worldwide Developers Conference, was a bit light on AI. Apple's recent WWDC 2025 keynote, while showcasing some new AI features like an AI health coach, visual intelligence for on-screen analysis, and Genmoji, conspicuously lacked a highly anticipated AI Siri update. This delay, which pushes the major Siri improvements to 2026, has raised questions about Apple's immediate AI capabilities compared to competitors like Google and Samsung, who have been rapidly rolling out advanced Gemini and Galaxy AI features. What is Apple's approach to AI? Apple Senior Vice President in Software Engineering, Craig Federighi, acknowledged the delay, stating, "We want to do this the right way." He further explained that Apple's prioritized quality and reliability over rushing out features, switching to a V2 architecture for Siri after the initial architecture didn't meet their standards. This suggests Apple's long-standing strategy of entering markets later, but with a highly polished and integrated product. Despite the criticisms, Apple's current AI strategy focuses on embedding Apple intelligence throughout its ecosystem rather than creating a standalone chatbot. This means users might not always realize they're interacting with AI, as it's designed to seamlessly enhance existing apps and workflows. Example of this integration from WWDC 2025 include visual intelligence, now able to analyze your iPhone screen from a screenshot and suggest actions or integrate with ChatGPT for more complex queries. Real-time translation for text in messages and audio in FaceTime and phone calls. AI-powered shortcuts, allowing for more intelligent automation of multi-step tasks. Workout Buddy, an AI coach on Apple Watch, offering real-time motivation and tips. Genmoji, an image background for creating custom emojis and manipulating images with AI. Why the delay with Siri? Federighi had indicated that the delay in the full AI supercharge Siri is due to the need for a more robust V2 architecture. The previous architecture, while functional internally, wasn't reliable enough to meet Apple's high standards for customer experience. This new architecture is a more comprehensive approach that extends across the entire Siri experience. The broader market's perspective is that while the public and market might be fixated on flashy AI chatbot features, Apple seems to believe that AI at present isn't the primary driver in the hardware sales. Traditional factors like camera improvements, form factor, and brand loyalty still play a significant role in customer purchasing decisions for iPhones. However, the rapid advancements in generative AI and large language models means that Apple may need to accelerate its AI integration to remain competitive in the near future. While Google and Samsung have been aggressive in launching various AI features, from advanced conversational AI to powerful image editing tools, Apple is betting on its wait-and-see approach, aiming to deliver truly useful and deeply integrated AI experiences rather than just being first to market. The success of this strategy hinges on whether their patience will indeed lead to superior and more impactful AI features for users. FBI warns iPhone and Android users to delete smishing texts amid rising scam threats. The FBI is warning iPhone and Android users in the United States to delete phony text messages claiming to be from toll road services, delivery companies, and government agencies. Scammers have targeted citizens in multiple states using this tool to steal personal and financial information. What are smishing texts? Newsweek reported that these threat actors use smishing texts, which is phishing attacks through SMS, from 10,000 newly registered domains using fake payment requests to access iPhone and Android users' sensitive information. This cyber threat has been ongoing for a year now. The FBI issued a public service announcement warning Americans about these smishing texts, which vary by state in the information they provide. The text claims that the recipient owes money for unpaid tolls and contain almost identical language. The FBI stated, the outstanding toll amount is similar among the complaints reported to the IC3. However, the link provided within the text is created to impersonate the state's toll service name, and phone numbers appear to change between states. The Federal Trade Commission also warned Americans about the cyber threat and what scammers are looking to gain from it. Not only is a scammer trying to steal your money, but if you click the link, they will get your personal info, like your driver's license number, and even steal your identity, the FTC said. The domains used in the text were from Chinese cyber criminal groups. The FBI also stated that the fake text messages always mention a minimal balance the person owes and provide a link for payment. State toll service name is one of the things that you'll notice on an outstanding toll amount of $12.51 on your record. To avoid a late fee of $50, visit, which happens to be a malicious website link, to settle your balance. According to Forbes, Palo Alto Networks Unit 42, a cybersecurity organization that provides threat intelligence, incident response, and cyber risk assessments, shared a report about the cyber threat and how Chinese cyber criminal groups likely created the domains. The company stated that the Chinese .xin TLD is added at the end of the following domains. Bleeping Computer reported that major U.S. cities, including Annapolis, Boston, Greenwich, Denver, Detroit, Houston, Milwaukee, Salt Lake City, Charlotte, San Diego and San Francisco have been targeted, with smartphone users receiving phishing text messages. However, in recent weeks, nearly 20 cities have been the most targeted between January and February, according to McAfee per Forbes. New York has also reported receiving easy-to-identify phishing texts. The text contained the dollar amount the person allegedly owed, with a dollar sign after the amount instead of before. That's one of the flags you should look for. McAfee also highlighted the most targeted cities. Look both ways for a new form of scam that's on the rise, especially if you live in Dallas, Atlanta, Los Angeles, Chicago, Orlando. Fake toll road scams. They're the top five cities getting targeted by scammers, the company stated, according to Forbes. What should you do after receiving a phishing text? The FBI provided steps to protect against text scams. File a complaint with the IC3 at www.ic3.gov, that's G-O-V, including the phone number and website from the text, verify accounts through legitimate toll service websites, contact customer service, and delete phishing texts. If information was shared or links clicked, secure personal and financial accounts and dispute any unfamiliar charges. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, sort of how they intertwine with each other. We talk about IT workers as well, and that brings us right up to a question that came from Peter, and it was more of a conversation that we had in regards to this issue of a court case off in India and how it applies to him. Now, quickly, the court case was with Vijaya. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that. Vijaya Bank, and it required new managers to sign a bond, and this was kind of a signing contract. Maybe it was. It appears to be some kind of a signing bonus that went along with this, and the whole concern there was to serve 3 years or to pay roughly in our equivalency $2,400 if the managers left early. Prashant Narnaware resigned in under 3 years, and he paid that fee, but he challenged the clause. He said, basically, this amounts to slavery, and I'm bringing this down into very simple terms. And the Supreme Court of India said, no, it doesn't. This was a pre-employment contract that was made, and that the damages were legal because it doesn't actually stop Prashant from leaving at any point in time. And many U.S. employers actually offer signing bonuses in exchange for a commitment. Usually there is some kind of requirement. If you go to work for them, you've got to stay on for a year or so. And if you leave early, you must repay the bonus. And these are generally enforceable contract terms. It's part of the bonus portion. It's enticing you to stay on, but not for you to come along and say, hey, I want the signing bonus. I want, you know, $200,000 a year and $100,000 signing bonus, and then you disappear a matter of a month after receiving the bonus. If that were the case, then everybody would be going around gathering in these signing bonuses, gathering up all that they could in the terms of wealth and all of these different stock options and offerings and all of that. And the reality of this is we are not actually slaves under something like this. And there are some nuances in this. There are some certain issues where in some states these are regulated, and they're regulated under wage laws. Overall, this is a recognized practice. There are certain situations where, yes, it can go downhill in the cases of something like liquidated damages. For instance, if actual damages are hard to calculate in advance or the stated amount is reasonable relative to a projected loss. However, here in the United States, if it sounds like it's some kind of a penalty, if it sounds like something that's punitive, is something that really nobody would ever expect, then the courts can come along and void it. Now, we've also seen some of these various contracts, along with signing bonuses, there's some kind of a non-compete, which restricts future employment. Now, some of these have been going through some legal battles recently, and we've seen some laws coming along that are restricting these, voiding them, especially if they exceed some level of reasonable time or geographic scope. Okay, so for instance, I go to work for a company and they say, okay, we're in the aerospace industry, and if you work for us, you can never work in the aerospace industry ever again. Well, that's not reasonable. They could say 10 years. That probably is not reasonable. They could say 1 year. That could be considered reasonable. If they are only doing business in California, and I'm just, you know, choosing where I used to live, they could say, well, we only do business in California. You can't get a job in the same industry within California. You can't go to any of our competitors in California. Now, let's flip that. If I go to New York, that is no longer valid because they don't have competitors in New York. Well, maybe they do, but those competitors are not reasonable competitors. So there's a lot of different things that all kind of mold into place here. And yes, there are some level of lock-in terms, usually based off of the bonus, that initial signing bonus, but they don't really limit you. This is something I wouldn't be concerned about. This isn't forced labor. It's not trapping you in a job forever. Instead, it is offering you a chunk of change, and hopefully a reasonable chunk of change, in return for you spending something more than 9 months, 6 months, whatever it is, with them. Can they require you to stay for the rest of your career? No, that's going to be something that they are going to have to basically face in court. Usually we're not going to see contracts like these in the United States. I've seen contracts like this with a couple of different folks I've worked with over the years. Nothing has been particularly onerous. Nothing's been particularly bad or scary or anything like this. So I wouldn't worry. I would say, yes, we need to watch this. We need to be very careful across the long haul because, yes, these things may change over the course of time. But as for today and how the laws work out right now, Peter, I think you're going to do just fine. Of course, I'm not an attorney. I don't even pretend to be one on the radio. So take this as what it's worth. Just some free commentary from a nerd. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Problem solving still matters in the tech industry. AI prompts may be weakening your creativity. Large language models are now common. They offer fast solutions, but over-reliance on them may hinder critical thinking. Experts say that the tech industry values problem-solving skills. Future tech leaders must think deeply. As large language models, that's LLMs, like ChatGPT and other platforms dominate digital spaces, concerns about their impact on human thinking and tech innovation are rising. What once required a process and manual effort has been compiled into a prompt. Enter it and get the results. LLMs are convenient, fast, and versatile, and provide solutions in minutes. But is this convenience coming at a hidden cost? Over the decades, AI has existed in many forms in spam filters, cybersecurity systems, recommendation engines, and early tools like Microsoft Word's Clippy. But with the rise of generative LLMs, AI has become far more accessible, advanced, and influential. Many of us are now using AI for the smallest things. Whether you want to send an email or text message, or even think about anything. Many professionals, especially in tech, are now relying on LLMs for code suggestions, product roadmaps, documentation, and idea generation. But what does it cost? Maybe our ability to think, visualize, and generate solutions? The risk of replacing problem solving with prompts? The growing dependency, even in software development and product management, has led to the automation of thinking. While LLMs are powerful assistants, relying on them too heavily can result in logic errors and loss of originality. Instead of building from first principles, developers may copy-paste surface-level solutions, which reduce the need for troubleshooting, system thinking, or understanding deeper patterns, skills that define engineering excellence. Problem-solving in tech isn't just about the output, whether that's a script, API, or design. It's about the process, debugging, architecting, testing, and iterating. This is where critical thinking, innovation, and real insight happens. When AI shortcuts that process, what we gain in speed, we may lose in depth, resilience, and learning. We risk weakening the cognitive muscles that help us grow as technologists. The post-LLM world still rewards thinkers, not just users. In a world driven by infinite tools and automated suggestions, the most valuable professionals will be those who can still think, adapt creatively, and see systems beyond the syntax. The challenge isn't whether AI will replace us, but whether we will forget how to build, solve, or think without it. The tech leaders of tomorrow will not just prompt well, they will question deeply, connect ideas, and stay human in an increasingly automated world. The Wall Street Journal reports Pentagon has been pushing Americans to believe in UFOs for decades. UFOs have been back in the news a lot lately, and it may be the case that the government wants it that way. The Wall Street Journal reported that the Defense Department has been responsible for creating and fostering the UFO mythology in America. The article shows that the government has, at various points over the years, purposely sown disinformation about UFOs in an effort to make Americans believe in little green men. This news comes as a result of an internal investigation by Sean Kirkpatrick, the head of the All-Domain Anomaly Resolution Office, with the acronym AARO, which was specifically set up within the Pentagon to investigate UFO sightings. Kirkpatrick, who spoke with the journal, says he found evidence that the government fabricated evidence of alien technology in an effort to distract from real weapons programs being carried out by the government in secret. The journal frames its findings as a stunning new twist in the story of America's cultural obsession with UFOs. But while the story's specific anecdotes are certainly new and quite interesting, its broader findings are not, nor are they particularly stunning. Instead, they parrot what many critics of the UFO narrative have long said, that the UFO mythos grew out of a disinformation campaign created by shadowy defense officials to obscure terrestrial secrets about America's national security community. Last year, the Wall Street Journal wrote a story with very much the same takeaway, having interviewed one prominent UFO critic, Mark Pilkington, who released a documentary in 2014 arguing that the government used disinformation specialists to lie to Americans and thus hide its covert activities. Still, the journal's investigation offers fresh details about a number of bizarre incidents that will surely tantalize the most avid UFO researchers. In particular, one episode revealed by Kirkpatrick's investigation involves a UFO sighting at a nuclear bunker that took place in 1967 and seemed to show that the government's disinformation efforts were not merely aimed at members of the public, but also its own staff. Robert Salas, A now 84-year-old former Air Force captain says that his former job was to man the bunker, which would have launched a nuclear strike against the Soviet Union in the event of a nuclear war. One night, Salah says that a glowing reddish-orange oval was seen hovering over the front gate of the facility by the building's guard. Not long afterwards, Salas discovered that the missiles at that facility had mysteriously been disabled. What had happened? Had aliens managed to disable the base's nuclear capabilities? The journal notes that a less supernatural, if still crazy, explanation for the episode may exist. Kirkpatrick's team dug into the story and discovered a terrestrial explanation. The barriers of concrete and silver surrounding Americans' nuclear missiles were thick enough to give them a chance if hit first by a Soviet strike. But scientists at the time feared the intense storm of electromagnetic waves generated by a nuclear detonation might render the hardware needed to launch a counterstrike unusable. To test this vulnerability, the Air Force developed an exotic electromagnetic generator that simulated this pulse of disruptive energy without the need to detonate a nuclear weapon. When activated, this device placed on a portable platform 60 feet above the facility would gather power until it glowed, sometimes with blinding orange light. It would then fire a burst of energy that could resemble lightning. Another intriguing anecdote that is shared in the report involves a bizarre custom that was inflicted upon newly inducted members of highly secretive government programs. Those inductees would be handed a picture of a UFO, Kirkpatrick found. For decades, certain new commanders of the Air Force's most classified programs, as part of their induction briefings, would be handed a piece of paper with a photo of what looked like a flying saucer. The craft was described as an anti-gravity maneuvering vehicle. The officers were told that the program they were joining, dubbed Yankee Blue, was part of an effort to reverse engineer the technology on the craft. They were told never to mention it again. Many never learned it was a fake. Kirkpatrick found the practice had begun decades before and appeared to continue still. The Defense Secretary Office sent a memo out across the service in the spring of 2023, ordering the practice to stop immediately, but the damage was done. Officials who spoke with a newspaper dubbed this practice a hazing ritual that spun out of control. But like most things associated with the UFO phenomenon, it's easy to find a different interpretation of events. Was this really a hazing ritual? Or was it part of an internal disinformation campaign designed to sow confusion and maintain cover for those secret programs, even within the programs themselves? Frankly, there's just no way to tell. Similarly, there is no way to tell whether the journal story hasn't been fudged up in some similar way. The simple truth is that when it comes to UFOs, it's impossible to trust anything that comes out of the mouth of a government or ex-government official. You're better off just giving up on trying to find the truth of the matter, which is, of course, exactly what the government wants. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, you know, one of the things I did recently was I upgraded my last system, the most important one for me, over to Windows 11. This actually represents something that is very strange for me because I've been on the beta version of every operating system going back to Windows 3.1. And
whoa.
on my primary system. And I just put it off because I was that scared. And I ran into a number of different issues along the way. As we move closer, we're starting to hear about people like the Linux crowd. They're saying, hey, look at us over here. Let's go in this direction. The Mac folks are laughing uproariously. You and I have not even delved into this topic in ages. What are your thoughts in regards to this progression towards Windows 11?
It's inevitable since Windows 10 support has been suspended by our friends at Microsoft.
Yes, yes.
So if you want to get updates, if you want to be safe, if you want things to keep working, and if you want the latest software to talk to your OS, it's kind of, you go or you never go anywhere. It's something you have to do. And I had put together, as you know, a desk side system that might have had 15 drives in it. Yeah. I think it had a RAID 5, a RAID 6 array and backups for backups. It had a backup for the boot drive. It had backups for the data drive and it had a couple other drives in there. I have no idea what's still on there.
But, tons of data.
I shut down one company 3 years ago and it's probably got its entire database history. Who knows? It did not have the security chip that was necessary to do an upgrade to Windows 11.
Yes, the TPM 2.0, yeah.
Yeah, and because of that, my choices were not upgrade unless I wanted to do a real scratch down to the motherboard, and in which case, expensive little things like the memory don't migrate. Or replace. Now, you're well aware that the horsepower in notebook systems, significantly better than it's ever been before.
It distinctly is. As a matter of fact, I'm arriving at what I think of internally in my brain. I have surpassed the expiration date. I've made this my primary system last a little bit longer than I normally do because I've been trying to figure out Windows 12, which isn't coming anytime soon. So my next thought has been to go towards, of all things, a laptop because this big, huge hunk of metal under my desk.
There's another part too.
Yeah.
One of the reasons we always went with system units was our ability to connect a lot of stuff, to vary what's in there, to add to them. And a lot of that functionality we can now get in docks.
Yes. Yes. Very much so.
So I have, what I got in, and we'll talk about this separately, is an expert book, an ASUS expert book, which is monstrously good. It's not terribly expensive. I think it's under $1,200, and it is able to do essentially everything I need because it's not trying to do it all inside a thin metal case. I've got two external drives connected to it, which total 6 terabytes, which is more than you're ever going to get inside one of these.
Yeah.
This particular model is a good value because it does not have an interactive screen. It's got a touchpad and of course, I always add a keyboard. I always add a trackball. I seldom count on the built-in audio mic or camera.
Sure.
But I do it more now.
Yeah.
At any rate, the migration path for me from 10 to 11 had to be buying a Windows 11 system. And notebook was the best way to get that. And in looking at the various alternatives there, I ended up migrating to ASUS. We've had a lot of really good experience with their products in the last couple of years. They're phenomenal. Yeah. You know, not that there's anything wrong with the other guys. I just, among other things, try to avoid things like bundleware that's a hallmark of so many brands.
So
as long as you don't care how thin a biscuit your USB ports are on, be grateful that you now have Thunderbolt 4, sometimes Thunderbolt 5 coming out of them. That means you've got up to, depending on the model you get, up to 40 gigabits per second of communication with any number of things in bidirectional context. It means you can add all the drives, all the peripherals you want. You can put in your SD cards. You can, you're not stuck with the notebook screen. You can add as many as 5-6 monitors depending on the configuration.
Sure, you're dealing. Yes, yes.
I would need more eyes. It's a good thing. Anybody now stuck in the 10 to 11, I would suggest go ahead with it. The only thing I'd suggest you keep an eye on to decide when to do it is how your end user pricing varies with the uncertainty of tariffs.
Yeah. I'm going to throw one more in. Remember to set aside and know that you're going to spend 4 hours post migration doing all the configuration and tweaking.
4 days for me, buddy.
There you go. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting IDs. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, June the 26th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is bcug.com. TED Ed Connect meets Tuesday, July the 1st. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Hybrid meeting. Meeting at the Scarsdale Public Library, located at 54 Olmsted Road in Scarsdale, New York, and online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, July 4th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. The website is acgnj.org. The King's Byte Computer Club meets Tuesday, July 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Park Plaza Restaurant, located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. The phone number to call is 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, July 10th, 2025, at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, July the 11th, 2025. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is limac.org. Happy computing! Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to Hank at pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, Marty Winston, and Mark Brownstein, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week.